confirming this appears to be a new strain of Ebola. His senior infectious disease specialist compared it to various strains of hemorrhagic fever in the Level 4 host site lab in Atlanta. It doesn't match any known samples, which indicates it is a strain that has evolved. The number of patients exhibiting symptoms in Richardson suggests it is airborne.
Jesus,
Lowe whispered. Also, just before I called this meeting, we received a call from a hospital in Denver. Same symptoms. Director Motley?
Mr. President, I received a call from Mr. Farber this morning on the developing situation. As you recall, 13 days ago, you were briefed on a hemorrhagic fever outbreak in Angola.
I remember.
It burned out, as I recall. That is correct, sir. My analysts linked the Angola outbreak with flights from Quatro de Fevereiro International Airport to the United States. Depending on a variety of factors, if we assume that the hemorrhagic fever from Angola is the same contagion now in the United States, it would mean that an infected passenger boarded a flight in Luanda sometime between 10 to 14 days ago. There has been one flight a day since the outbreak from Angola to Johannesburg. From Johannesburg, there have been two flights a day to JFK and Atlanta, with connecting flights to the rest of the country, not to mention the flights out of Johannesburg to the rest of the world. My agency is working with the FBI to track the passengers and flights from Angola to South Africa to the United States. We are reaching out to our counterparts worldwide to find out if there are any other outbreaks. Preliminary analysis suggests that connecting passengers during the time frame in question did take connecting flights to Dallas and Denver.
The gravity of the threat momentarily turned a meeting of the National Security Council into a prayer service, as silence gripped a group not accustomed to silent reflection.
Director Lowe, the president said, addressing the DNI, give me some options.
Sir, certain protocols automatically engage in the event of a threat to critical infrastructure from nuclear, biological, or chemical attack. This naturally occurring event falls under the parameters of that executive order. I'll turn it over to Director Cruz, who is versed in the details.
Cruz stood and addressed the room.
Mr. President, as you are well aware, CISA's mission was envisioned during the Obama administration out of concern for attacks on critical infrastructure. The previous administration officially formed CISA as a component of the Department of Homeland Security, but in times of crisis, as an independent agency with direct report to the executive branch for action. The world has never dealt with a respiratory spread hemorrhagic fever. If the CDC confirms that Ebola is in fact airborne, it has the potential to spread at a rate unparalleled in the history of infectious disease.
What kind of mortality rates are we talking about? The president asked.
Without containment measures, it has the potential to kill 90% of the country. Over 290 million people.
For the first time in as long as he could remember, the president was at a loss.
Greg, do we have contingency plans for an outbreak of that magnitude?
Sir, Farber hesitated. The sensitivity of those plans requires a smaller audience.
Smaller than this?
Sir, we are in uncharted territory, Farber said.
This is the National Security Council, the president said, reasserting his authority. We will all be briefed on the contingencies.
Yes, sir, Farber said.
General?
General Nathan Seifert stood to address the room. Even though this was an emergency meeting on a Saturday morning, he was clean-shaven and his uniform was immaculate. Though it was obvious he could no longer pass the Army PT test, he was stern and direct. By his way of thinking, at this stage of his career, the American people were not paying him to pass a 2-mile timed run. They were paying him to advise the President of the United States and the members of the National Security Council as the highest-ranking military officer in the country. Though he hid his contempt, he maintained no regard for those senior-level officers who hid their intellectual ineptitude behind their annual PT scores.
Mr. President, by way of background, in the years following World War II, it was revealed that the Nazi and Imperial war machines had experimented with bioweapons as a way to destroy the enemy without firing a shot. President Eisenhower tasked the United States military to develop protocols in the event a biological weapon were released in the continental United States. Those containment and eradication plans have been updated on a periodic basis since inception in 1954.
Containment and eradication? The president inquired.
Yes, Mr. President. To stop the spread of either a bioweapon or a naturally occurring highly contagious virus that threatened to destroy the country, a fail-safe last resort plan was developed in the 1950s. Only a select number of people have ever been briefed on the contingency.
General Seifert looked at the Secretary of Defense, who nodded.
Mr. President, there are protocols in place to isolate areas, to include cities, in the case of a contagion event. Troops are staging as we speak in advance of a containment order.
An eradication? The President asked.
If the pathogen escapes the perimeter and threatens to infect and destroy the nation, we can rapidly expand the containment zone. There are MC-130 aircraft on standby in Hurlburt Field, Florida. Those planes are equipped with GBU-43B Massive Ordnance Air Blast Fuel Air Explosive Munitions, the most devastating non-nuclear bombs in our inventory.
The President leaned forward and cleared his throat. General, are you telling me we have had plans in place to destroy our own cities since the early days of the Cold War?
That is correct, sir. Even the pilots and crews don't know their mission. The squadron believes they are on standby for a Cuban contingency, more specifically a Chinese buildup in Cuba. Their CAE flight simulators are only programmed for OCON-US contingencies.
And why am I just finding out about this now?
Sir,
the National Security Advisor offered,
there are several military contingency plans in place, their existence only revealed through a triggering event.
Christensen's head was spinning. Dear Lord, give me strength.
If I may, sir,
Cruz interjected. The President nodded.
Mr. President, you may remember Operation Jade Helm in 2015. It was a continental U.S.-based exercise. 1,200 troops mobilized across 20 Texas cities. Under the guise of a military exercise surrounding a potential asteroid strike, FEMA tested citizen response to martial law. In 2017, a similar exercise called Operation Gothic Shield moved military forces into and around New York City. This time, the cover was an exercise to combat a potential nuclear threat to Manhattan. Martial law was again tested on the citizenry. Based on the findings of Jade Helm and Gothic Shield, CISA was created in 2018 to coordinate a whole-of-government response to a cyber warfare attack. But its charter more broadly applies to all acts of terrorism against U.S. critical infrastructure. During the COVID-19 crisis, CISA conducted trial runs in Portland and Chicago. What were the findings? He asked. That small pockets of resistance emerged, organized primarily through social media. Algorithms are now refined and in place through our partners in the technology sector to reduce the spread of information intended to incite violence.
The President leaned back in his chair.
Jesus.
Continue, the President said, weighing the implications. The Bioterrorism Act of 2002 first delegated authorities to HHS. Ill-equipped to handle a crisis of this magnitude, the Department of Homeland Security was tasked with building response mechanisms to a bioterrorism attack. Those same protocols apply to a naturally occurring event like a respiratory spread hemorrhagic fever in the continental United States.
And what was designated as critical infrastructure? The President asked.
That was and is a living document, Mr. President, Director Cruz said. There are multiple lists at various government agencies that all vary, not so much as to the definition, but to the entities actually listed.
Explain, the President said.
Under Presidential Directive 7, there are 16 infrastructure sectors critical to the defense of the United States, our economic security, and our public health and safety.
What are they? The President asked.
Nuclear, chemical, agriculture, healthcare, water, energy, critical manufacturing,
Communications, dams, commercial facilities, emergency services, financial services, government facilities, transportation systems, information technology, and the defense industrial base. That doesn't really narrow it down. What's not on that list? Initially, critical infrastructure was designated by a working group from Homeland Security. When COVID-19 shut down the country, those on the critical infrastructure list continued to operate. That put critical infrastructure on the radar for most Americans, some of whom owned companies and were politically connected. The president knew exactly where this was headed. Political donations began pouring in, followed by requests for certain businesses to be added to the critical infrastructure list through special interest groups and lobbying firms. Today, the list includes shopping malls, gaming operations, and stadiums, in addition to the list created by Homeland Security Working Group. The president shook his head and leaned back in his chair.
Typical Washington.
He looked around the room, his eyes coming to rest on his national security advisor. Greg, approve containment for Richardson and Denver. If it's respiratory, everyone on those planes could be infected. God knows where they are now.
Yes, sir.
Recommendations, the president said to the table, his eyes coming to rest on the director of the CIA.
Mr. President,
Motley said,
my agency is working with the FBI to confirm we have the manifests from all flights to the United States from Angola. We are coordinating with Homeland Security to quarantine and test those individuals, and with your authorization, we'll institute executive contact tracing protocols with the technology sector so we can determine how far the virus has spread.
Is that legal? Christensen asked his national security advisor, noting for the first time that the White House counsel was conspicuously absent.
We have memorandums of understanding in place to acquire that information. However, it will take an executive order to mandate isolation for confirmed contact traces. The previous administration prepared one for COVID-19. We can use it as a model and cite it for precedent.
When will we know if it has spread outside of Denver and Richardson? Farber nodded to Motley.
We will know in the next 24 to 48 hours.
The president looked to his Secretary of Defense, William Dare, a quiet and thoughtful former Marine flag officer, often uncomfortable in a city where most speak before even bothering to study their history or form a coherent opinion. Born in Oregon of Lebanese descent, he had been one of the few general officers who spoke Arabic when the United States committed large-scale forces to the Middle East and Central Asia. A graduate of the United States Naval Academy, during his time in uniform, he earned a master's in Middle Eastern studies at Harvard before being selected as an Olmsted Scholar studying at the University of Jordan in Amman. Upon retirement, he accepted a position at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and a board position at the president's former startup, now one of the most powerful and profitable companies in history. Christensen tapped him for SecDef early in the transition process, and his confirmation hearings were the most civil in recent memory.
Bill, what does it take to launch the MC-130s? If it comes to that, will those crews drop on an American city?
Mr. President, I have instructed the 15th Special Operations Squadron at Hurlburt to forward me SF-86 security paperwork for each crew to determine if they have family in the affected areas. Your executive order will also allow us to access their social media accounts. Those with family and friends in the target cities will be pulled from the rotation and replaced.
Turning back to his national security advisor, the president asked,
and to confirm, so far there are no cases outside of Richardson and Denver?
Correct, Mr. President.
Greg, I am going to address the nation.
Yes, Mr. President, the basement is designed with that provision.
Not from the basement, from the Oval Office.
Sir, I strongly recommend remaining on lockdown until we have a clearer picture of how fast this is spreading.
Greg, the American people need to know we are not in a panic. Staying in an actual basement did not play well for leaders during COVID-19. I need to inform the American people that military forces will be containing areas in Texas and Colorado before they see it on the news or walk outside and see
Humvees and Bradley fighting vehicles staging in their local Walmart parking lots. General Seifert, what is the status of troops in Texas and Colorado?
They are moving to bases in closer proximity to the affected areas to await your containment order.
Then we don't have much time. I want to head this off. I don't see a viable alternative to containment, but by God, we need to move heaven and earth to avoid eradication. Let me be clear. There is nothing we will not do to ensure we never have to face the possibility of eradication. We are all going upstairs. I'm going to address the nation from the Oval Office at 9 a.m. Eastern. Make it happen.
Chapter 31. Richardson, Texas. The response came unusually fast for a town typically mired in the sludge of the literal and figurative swamp. The president's address from the Oval Office was broadcast live at 9 o'clock a.m. Eastern. By the time those on the West Coast were pouring their first cups of coffee, it was the talk of cable news. With no shortage of experts to choose from after the experience of COVID-19, every channel had panels of talking heads expounding on pandemics, epidemics, hemorrhagic fever, vaccines, masks, shutdowns, and the legality of contact tracing. The hashtag outbreak began trending on social media, and the 1995 Dustin Hoffman movie of the same name experienced a resurgence on Hulu. The events of September 11, 2001 had not only put the country on war footing, they had set in motion a flood of convoluted congressional directives and acts, resulting in a series of new authority chains, departments, and agencies that effectively handed additional power to the executive branch. The president now had more control and discretion on applying military force than at any time in the nation's history. In order to streamline and expedite certain decisions, CISA had automated initial steps in the decision-making process to protect critical infrastructure. In the case of a naturally occurring virus, forces identified as essential to containment measures were put on standby before the president had reached the secure space under the North Lawn. As part of their classified mission set, the Air Force Global Strike Command at Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport, Louisiana, was put on alert. Tasked with continental United States unconventional responses, they notified component commands and began to consolidate forces at predetermined staging locations across the country. The United States Northern Command at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs activated the Unified Action Layered Defense Strategy Op Plan, federalizing the troops of Special Operations Command North. This brought Special Operations personnel trained to fight an enemy overseas under the control of a command focused on maintaining peace and security within the borders of the continental United States. While the Commander-in-Chief was addressing the nation from the Oval Office, the 1st Special Forces Command, established in 2014 at Fort Bragg, was activating the recall of intelligence, psychological operations, civil affairs, and sustainment assets for follow-on movement to Dyess Air Force Base in Abilene, Texas. Blackhawks and Little Birds from the Special Operations Aviation Regiment in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, were loaded into C-130s and lifted off to stage within striking distance of the affected areas. They had been flying in major U.S. cities and population centers for years as part of exercises termed realistic urban training with special mission units out of Virginia Beach and Fort Bragg. In Florida, C-130J transports were wheels up from Eglin Air Force Base en route for Dyess and Buckley Air Force Base in Aurora, Colorado. As the president closed out his address, local news outlets were already broadcasting videos of tanks, Bradleys, helicopters, and troop transports staging for what looked like an invasion, giving rise to a number of conspiracy theories across the new media. A crisis was always good for news outlets and their advertisers. Dyess and Buckley Air Force Bases were converted to military command centers. By the time the president approved the order to contain the outbreak, forces were already in place to respond. All flights in and out of Dallas, Denver, and surrounding areas
to include private aviation, were grounded, while restricted airspace designations were immediately put in place via NOTAMs, Notices to Airmen. Though the president never mentioned martial law in his address, it became the topic of the day. Never mentioned in the Constitution, not clearly defined by an act of Congress or by Supreme Court ruling, martial law has been enacted more than 60 times since 1776, perhaps most infamously by General Andrew Jackson in New Orleans during and after the War of 1812. Lawyers, pundits, and military analysts debated the merits of the Insurrection Act, Posse Comitatus, along with Title 10, Title 32, and Title 50 of the U.S. Code. As they talked, argued, and cycled through commercial breaks, the United States military took up positions outside Richardson and Aurora.